Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
The Ronaldo situation is a total and utter nightmare. And it's no surprise that we're now seeing noises that Ten Hag effectively wants him gone as soon as possible.
And Bono, it's four! It's brilliant from Brentford. They are demolishing Manchester United.
Hello, Dan Bardell here with you alongside George Ellick and Tim Spears. Last week we got George to deliver us his hot take straight out of the gate, and this week, Tim, it's your turn to go first.
I was going to talk about how amazing Arsenal look just to go on the back of what George was saying last week, but no, I'll spare him that. I think Manchester United have officially now taken on Arsenal's mantle as the big club to laugh at in English football.
It's for sure.
It's been Arsenal for a few years, and last season there was a bit of Arsenal, a bit of United, but even my mum and my sister were talking about Man United after the Brentford defeat, and they know absolutely nothing about football and they couldn't care less, but it's still of interest to everybody. So yeah, just incredible scenes across the country when those goals were going in.
I mean, if they know nothing about football, they could probably run Manchester United, because that's how bad it is there at the moment. George, I noticed that Edouard didn't score again, by the way.
Yeah, he didn't even start, mate. So I feel like this is a bit unfair, this whole Edouard narrative, where when you put up a 125-1,
I'm going to enjoy it.
Throwaway bet at a big price, then you look clever by saying it's not going to happen.
My take is hot, because I've only just thought of it because I forgot to do one. My hot take is that Newcastle can finish sixth this season.
Sixth?
That's
not that hot. I thought you were going to say they finished second.
That was a hot take. I think Newcastle fans would be absolutely delighted with sixth place. I think Manchester United obviously have got a massive chance of not finishing in the top six. West Ham have got the Conference League. I would have made them probably the next favourites to take that spot after the last few years. But I really think, especially if they get one more signing in Newcastle, I think they can finish top
so Newcastle
six and have a really, really strong
Newcastle
season.
9-4 with the bookies to finish in the top six. It's a lukewarm take, I think, that one.
Okay, well, I'll go with my lukewarm take then. It's better than saying things like Edouard, top league goal scorer.
That was hot.
That's for sure. That is a very, very hot take, George. Let's look at the weekend's Premier League then, but we're going to start with Monday night football this week, which is Manchester United against Liverpool. I mean, Tim, where do we even start with Manchester United at the moment? That game against Brentford, has there ever been a worse 25-minute spell for a Premier League team ever?
The one that springs to mind would be Arsenal shipping four against Newcastle when they were 4-0 up. So that was four in 19 minutes.
That's bad.
But that was a stirring comeback instigated by Newcastle. And as you know, as good as Brentford were, and they were incredible and they were ruthless, one of the greatest days in their history, but United did hand them goals, literally, via David De Gea, a combination of Maguire and Eriksen trying to play out. The fact it was Brentford who did this to Man United is a surprise in a sort of a historical sense, because it's Brentford. It's not surprising the fact that Brentford are a very competent team and potentially an improving team, as we were discussing last week. But it's just utterly humiliating for Manchester United Football Club, as Gary Neville would say. And we're still looking for that rock bottom. When does it come? I don't think it can come on Monday, because they've already been thrashed by five at home by Liverpool. It's incredible. It's a circus. I love reading about it. I love watching it. It's one of the biggest stories in English football in recent years, this capitulation, and it shows no sign of slowing down.
Yeah, George, I mean, if you look at where Brentford were in the football pyramid, I don't know, 10 years ago, let's say, and where Manchester United were just before that now, to look at how Brentford just absolutely ripped them to shreds, took advantage of frailties, took advantage of weaknesses. Now, Brentford are a team that know what they are. They know what they're doing. They've got a plan behind the scenes. Manchester United now just tick none of those boxes.
I think that was what was so interesting about this game and this story, was just how striking the contrast is between the two clubs. You know, not only did you have Brentford beating Manchester United, but you had Brentford in their shiny new stadium, whilst United's famous Old Trafford rots, as their fans say. You have United, who are being run by American owners who have no affinity to the club, who, you know, as we know, have made a lot of money out of the club itself, compared to Brentford, who are owned by a fan, Matthew Benham, a fan who is an expert in what it is to win football matches. You know, he made his money by being able to accurately predict betting, you know, betting on football matches. That is how he amassed his fortune, and he's used that expertise in terms of building a football club. You have Thomas Frank, a manager who was part of the club during the spell of a previous manager in Dean Smith. Good succession planning built by the club. No need to go and tear everything apart and start again when an influential manager left. Compared to Manchester United, who are onto their fifth, sixth managerial appointment since the all-important manager moved on. Brentford are an example of how to run a football club, of how to, you know, they are the blueprint, I think, not just for small EFL clubs now, for every single club, and how to recruit well and how to build sustainably and not just set fire to cash in terms of chasing after some golden egg. Whereas Manchester United have to now be the threat. They have to be what clubs look at as saying, if we make bad decisions, if we do not employ the right people, it doesn't matter how much money you spend, things can still go incredibly wrong. And again, when you look at the players who scored the goals for Brentford, whether it's Mbeumo, whether it's Jensen, it's smart recruitment. It is looking at areas where players are still represent monetary value and can be sold on for profit afterwards, rather than Manchester United, who just seem intent on fishing in the same waters, just going after players who are playing for some of the biggest clubs in the world, but are available and are going to come at a premium because they've already proven themselves at the top level. It is not a smart way to recruit. You see no top clubs doing that at all. It's like going after Galacticos whose stars have already fallen. It doesn't make any sense. I don't think it's going to be rock bottom. I think, as Tim said, we've seen them get beat heavily against Liverpool. We're going to get onto the game shortly, and I think there are possibly some reasons in isolation about this game that could be of relief to Manchester United fans. But given how poor the performance was, given how much of the damage was self-inflicted by Manchester United players and by their setup and by the whole mentality of the club, and just how long this malaise has gone on, it doesn't feel like the kind of performance and result that's going to represent an opportunity to bounce back, especially given that in the aftermath of the match itself, we've seen the club being linked to 25 players. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous what seems to be going on. And none of them on paper, apart from possibly Casemiro, look to be particularly what they need or the kind of characters they need or smart signings. And then you look at the finances involved and it's hard to make a case for anyone being a sensible signing based on the amount of money it's going to take them to bring in these players. And they're being held to a ransom, whether it's Rabiot's mum demanding that he's the highest paid player in the Premier League to now the wages being touted by those in the media about the signing of Casemiro as well. It's a total and utter mess, and a circus is absolutely right. And yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see more days like Saturday before it gets any better.
Yeah, before we get into the actual game, let's listen to a clip from the Talk of the Devils podcast that's on The Athletic. Now, if you're a Manchester United fan or just someone who gets joy from the pain of others, then you might want to listen to this clip now and listen to the podcast in general. Let's hear the clip then as Andy Mitten wonders what might happen at Old Trafford if Liverpool dish out another battering on Monday.
Because if Liverpool were 4 up as they were in the equivalent fixture last season at half-time, I think that would be the straw which breaks the camel's back for a lot of moderate Manchester United fans. I remember you giving an example with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, 2nd of October last year. I said, he's starting to lose the moderates here. And he lost them. He never got them back and he lost his job 6 weeks later. I think that sensible Manchester United fans who might not have any interest in the politics, they would have a breaking point as well. And if United were on the way to losing the third game at the start of the season, I think you're going to see a major real-life reaction. What form that takes, we don't know. But it might just be that natural reaction. It's going to be on television. And fans can show many ways of showing their disdain.
Yep, could be some hostility at Old Trafford on Monday night, Tim. But I'm not even saying this to tie the mick, but at this point, a heavy defeat is... I just expect it.
Yeah, absolutely. And really interesting listening to Andy there. There was sort of apathy last season, really, finishing sixth and trundling along, but that will quickly turn to anger, and that position of 20th in the table is very stark and will bring it home for a lot of Man United fans as to just the crisis that they're in, really. I'm also interested to see if Erik ten Hag escapes criticism. You know, he's the man in charge of putting these players on the field and coaching them, and he's been in charge since, I guess, April, effectively, when he was appointed, you know. He's had a whole pre-season to work with them, and I think we've said the last couple of weeks, you know, we've got to go easy on him, and that's absolutely right. But when you're playing Eriksen in a false nine 1 week and a DM the next, then you have to start to to question the decisions he's making. But obviously the problems are far, far, far bigger than him. And go back a very long time, that figure of £1 billion, I really struggled to get my head around it. They spent £1 billion on players in the past decade and got worse. It's astonishing mismanagement, the scale of which we probably haven't seen in financial terms in English football before.
Do you think Ten Hag is blameless? It's very difficult to blame him, as Tim says, George, in that, you know, he's barely had any time. He's not really been able to get in the kind of players that he would want. But he's trying to get players to do things that they can't do. I watched David De Gea, I watched Harry Maguire, and you know, Harry Maguire doesn't want to give the ball to David De Gea. David De Gea doesn't want to give the ball to Harry Maguire because they don't trust each other. You got Eriksen even managing to look bad, and Eriksen's a sensational footballer. To make Christian Eriksen look bad, there obviously is something wrong on the pitch, but how much blame can you put to Ten Hag at the moment, do you think?
I think it's very difficult to know. He's certainly not blameless, but similarly, and he kind of alluded to it as well, when you see your goalkeeper who, you know, for all of De Gea's faults, he's probably been Manchester United's most consistent performer over the difficult times. That's not to say that he's been faultless. He absolutely hasn't been, but he has been a fairly dependable pair of hands when things haven't necessarily been so good.
I completely disagree. Well,
I'm not necessarily saying he has been blameless. I think United fans themselves have seen De Gea as reliability isn't the right word. He's been someone who's shown up to the fans when needed, who's been probably a little bit of quality.
He fronts exactly. The back of the game,
like
I'll give him that.
I think you can set him apart from the other underperforming players who've seemingly been like fairly spineless throughout the whole thing. And the first goal, I think when your keeper makes that kind of a mistake, and for all of De Gea's mistakes, that is you know, probably the most pronounced. As Ten Hag said, your game plan does somewhat go out of the window. And I don't think you can necessarily legislate for individual mistakes. Standards should be higher, of course, but there is quite clearly a real confidence issue running throughout that Manchester United side as well. And now, you know, I think normally when you see an elite coach take on a group of players who have played at the levels we've seen this United squad before, normally you see a clear improvement in terms of the way they play going into the season. But there have been other circumstances. You know, the Ronaldo situation is a total and utter nightmare for Manchester United. You know, if we go back 12 months, the club were rejoicing that they'd managed to re-sign their former player, one of the best players they've ever had, one of the greatest players the world's ever seen, from their neighbour's grasp. And now it's got to go down as one of the most catastrophic signings, not just because Ronaldo himself isn't what they need. Now, he had a decent season last season, the goal tally was okay, but I think the destruction of having the poster boy for Manchester United in this century, so clearly trying to force his way out whilst also taking on an extortionate wage at this stage of his career, and embodying the lethargy that has, you know, summarised Manchester United's on-pitch performances recently is a nightmare. And it's no surprise that we're now seeing noises that Ten Hag effectively wants him gone as soon as possible. But then they have no one to replace him with. As Tim said, playing Christian Eriksen as a false nine in Ronaldo's absence on opening day was just a sign of just how bad the transfer window had been. So I don't think he's blameless. I think that the most striking thing for me throughout all of this, and there are many reasons to criticise the Glazers, but the fact that the people making the decisions upstairs at Manchester United, at Old Trafford, the fact that there still isn't some kind of a sporting director, some kind of a director of football, somebody with some kind of track record in terms of being able to recruit well, knowing his way around the transfer market, after window of overspending and bad player ID, it must just come down to just sheer arrogance of the people who have to make that hire, that it's not necessary. It seems mad to me that we've seen, you know, we've seen Dan Ashworth move on, and not just Manchester United, that there are so many other Premier League or below wise, clever people whose actual job it is to manage this side of the business. But one of the biggest clubs in the world don't think they need that. And I think it's never been more evident than it is at the moment that is absolutely essential for them if they're ever going to get out of this slump.
This isn't a solution, and there's a bit of a classic sort of fan last resort. Not that I'm a Man United fan, but where are the kids? Like this unbelievable academy that they've got. They won the Youth Cup last year. They must have some exceptionally talented youngsters who can surely come in and show the desire and motivation that others aren't, and do what the head coach asked them to do.
I think Manchester United fans would have, I think they are pretty patient in all honesty at the moment, but I think they'd have a degree of patience if there was a case of you were seeing young players bloodied. Like at the moment, what do they lose by James
Garner? And now he's up for sale, which I think a lot of fans would be rightly disappointed.
That makes no sense.
But there's an irony as well, where Garner is the kind of profile signing that Manchester United should be looking to make if he wasn't even their player. You look back at the team that Fergie built, you look back at the players, you know, the way that he built that team, the way they recruited, it was looking and plucking, like the cherry picking the best homegrown talent within clubs perceived to be smaller than Manchester United. James Garner has had an unbelievably good 18 months at Forest. He's shown himself to be a quality midfield player. He already belongs to them. He's a Manchester United fan. He's somebody who, you know, the whole club, the whole fan base want to see. Not only are they not playing him, but they're putting him up for sale. It's just how he can't be of use, even as like a PR stunt at this stage, just to get people on side again, it beggars belief.
It's absolutely baffling. Let's look at Liverpool then a little bit, Tim. Stodgy start, Liverpool. Not the start that was expected at all. I thought Fulham played very, very well, and I did think that Crystal Palace had a good game plan at Anfield that worked. And then obviously the sending off, which we'll come on to, was mindless. But it's so far not the Liverpool way under Klopp, not playing with any real temper. Feels like Mane is a massive miss at the moment, not being in that side, and just not the start we were expecting.
Mane is a miss, and you're right, something doesn't quite feel right there, and there's a bit of tetchiness around the club as well, speaking publicly, not just Klopp but Milner as well, about them starting slowly in games. And I know they've got a horrendous list of injuries at the moment.
Central midfield's a problem at the moment.
It is. Thiago's out, Firmino's out, Matip, Jota, Konate, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Curtis Jones, Joe Gomez added to the list last week. Henderson could only make the bench. He wasn't fit enough to start. Now Nunes is suspended. That is a ridiculous list, and I think we have to take that into account. They also dominated that Palace game for long periods. Yes, they should have won, and we saw Palace against Arsenal. They can cause teams problems. I did think Liverpool would thrash them personally. So yeah, they're already playing catch up, really. We've seen that they can go on steamroller type runs and win 15 in a row, but unfortunately for them, Man City can do that as well. So it's only two games and 4 points in, but it does matter. With Diaz and Salah and all the other talents they've got, I'd still expect them to beat Man United on Monday, but there'll be some slight concerns there from Klopp at the start they've made, definitely.
Tim just touched on it then, George. 4 points on the face of it isn't a lot, but even after two games, just the way Manchester City operate and the way they win games, 4 points already does feel, you know, that's going to be difficult to pull back. There is no margin for error with those two because the standards that they've set have been so high.
That's it. But when you look at how many games per season Manchester City drop points in, it's very few. So if you're already dropping points in two games out of two, you're not leaving yourself much room for error in the following, you know, 36. And for Liverpool, you know, they come into this game, there's a massive expectation that they will win. It's also a game that obviously matters a lot to their fans beyond leaving the Premier League tilt and chasing down Manchester City, because they love to beat Manchester United. But the injury issues are significant, I think. You know, I think having Nat Phillips playing centre-back, you know, he's not, in my mind, necessarily a Premier League centre-back. You know, he played at Bournemouth last season for the second half of the campaign. I wasn't particularly impressed with him there for the second half of a Championship season. You've then got Nunez coming out with you know, as Tim mentioned, the injury troubles up front as well. Could this mean that Carvalho makes his first start in the front three? A player that I really like, nearly scored an unbelievable goal to win the game against Palace. That volley, they just whistled wide. But again, is he ready for this kind of an atmosphere, this kind of game? So, look, I think Liverpool are overwhelming favourites to win this one. I do think in games like this, sometimes the form book kind of goes out the window. I think at least United know that they're playing, you know, in a way, for United having slipped on two banana skins, it might suit them a little bit not to have the expectation, the burden of expectation on their shoulders. We'll see. But similarly, they will have probably some trauma after what's happened in the past in these games against Liverpool, where not only are they well beaten, but they're toyed with for the majority of it as well. So I think it'll be interesting to see what Liverpool's team is when the teams are announced on Monday evening, because it could, you know, they could be significantly weakened, but it's probably clutching at straws eventually. And with Luis Diaz and Mo Salah playing, it doesn't really matter what's behind you, given the amount of time they're going to get on the ball in United's final third. It seems very unlikely that they're not going to be able to hurt them.
Yeah, and there's a great piece from Andy Jones on Mark Carey on how many points a team can drop if they want to win the title. City drew 5 and 6 games in the last two seasons. When Liverpool won the league in 2019-20, they only drew 3 games and lost 3. So they are already on the back foot. And normally I'd ask you for predictions, but at this point I might as well ask you what the meaning of life is, so I'm not even going to bother with that. And we're going to move straight over to Tottenham against Wolves, which is the Saturday lunchtime game. And Tim, it's also the Tim Spears derby.
Yeah, do you know, I'm not even going going though.
Oh, that's very disappointing. That's very disappointing.
I'm going to a festival, Dan.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Team.
I'm going to try and watch it though. I will watch it.
At a festival?
No.
What festival is this? I want to go. They've got the games on.
No, this will be in the pub beforehand, then it's off to the festival. It's only down the road.
Spurs rescuing a point in stoppage time at Stamford Bridge, Tim. Chelsea, I thought, were very, very good on the day. You can't legislate for that, but it's great for Spurs that they got that 2-2 draw, and it just shows what Conte teams are all about. Do you think that late goal, the reaction after it being with their fans, do you think it will galvanise them heading into this next
game? Yeah, I agree with you. I was tending to look more at Chelsea's excellent performance rather than Spurs struggling to get a foothold in the game, which they did, but I felt that was more down to Tuchel's tactics more than anything. Chelsea should have won that game, and they'll have been kicking themselves afterwards or kicking the opposition manager or whatever it might be. But Spurs, for me, they've kind of shown two really important facets that they'll need if they're going to challenge, you know, top three, top two, or even better this season. They've had goals from five different scorers so far, which is massive. I mean, Son hasn't scored yet. Kane got off the mark at the weekend. So that bodes really well, especially since, you know, Richarlison hasn't started a game yet. None of their new signings have started a game yet.
I thought that was a big thing to come out of the game, is that just having that extra forward option in bringing Richarlison kind of, it got them back to 1-1 really, didn't it? Having Richarlison next to Kane up there with him, that kind of pulled the momentum back to Spurs for a little bit. So just having that extra player to bring on is massive and changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Up.
And then the fight that they showed, I mean, we spoke last week about Tottenham's record at Stamford Bridge. What was it? What, 1-37? Something insane like that. You know, I don't think you can underestimate from a Tottenham fans' point of view that the fear of going to Chelsea away. I mean, a point was a fantastic result for in the eyes of the majority of them. And Conte's fear too, maybe, with Chelsea. He brings up Chelsea a lot in press conferences as a sort of a team and a club that Spurs should be aiming to look to be. The thing with Spurs is this has to be backed up now with victories over Wolves and Nottingham Forest in the next week or so, if they're going to really sort of start to stake a claim for what they're looking to do this season. They've got some injury worries as well, but no, I was from a Spurs point of view really heartened with them, with how they claimed that comeback at the weekend.
Yeah, I think Spurs fans would have taken a point beforehand, a lot of Spurs fans who I spoke to, so then to get the point having not played great and Chelsea being as good as they were, just a huge day for Tottenham Hotspur. George, Tim's touched on the injuries there. Christian Romero could miss up to 4 weeks. That's a big blow for Spurs because he's a massive part of how they play. To me, he almost reminds me of Conte a little bit on the pitch in the way he plays the game. He'll be a huge miss because he was a big part of their resurgence in the second half of the season.
Yeah, quality player. And as you say, I think his battling qualities kind of summarise what Antonio Conte Spurs are all about, and he will be a loss. You know, they are lucky they've got some quality in that area in terms of depth. I guess Sanchez is the likeliest one who'll come in ahead of this. I thought Perisic showed...
That's a downgrade, though. That is a downgrade.
I mean, how often do you get an injury to a key player that isn't a downgrade? But, you know, I think it's all about...
Natural.
You know, Sanchez isn't a bad option to have as your backup centre-back. And Perisic, I thought, was impressive when he came on. I think we're going to see Spurs score quite a few from set pieces if his delivery is going to consistently be as good as it was after he came on against Chelsea. It wouldn't surprise me if he came in for Sessegnon for this, which I guess if we're looking at upgrades and downgrades would be an upgrade for them. In my view, I kind of thought that we would see Spurs have more of the game against Chelsea than we did. You know, I know Chelsea were at home. I know they're very strong at Stamford Bridge, but I was surprised maybe by how much Chelsea dominated the ball and dominated the territory. And that wasn't, I don't think, a game plan from Spurs. I don't think Spurs were happy to relinquish the ball. I think Chelsea just controlled the game far better. Now, obviously, the important thing here is that the points were shared. They drew 2-2. And Spurs, I think, on balance of play, will be delighted by that point because, you know, they were chasing the ball for the majority of the game. I'm not necessarily downgrading the way I perceive Spurs to be this season, but I was maybe a little bit surprised that they weren't able to impose themselves a bit more on the game. I thought Chelsea were excellent.
Tim, let's move on to Wolves now. I described them on Sky earlier as having exploded into life this transfer window now. They're making some smart signings.
You're the first
signings,
to say that, Dan, I think.
Some good signings. It's not my favourite thing to have to sign a podcast, to be honest, George. I'm not going to lie about it. But now that special relationship again and the profile of player that they bring in is paying dividends, because that's a big signing, particularly in central midfield with Matias Nunes.
A huge signing. I mean, I had a good look at him early this year when David Ornstein first broke the news that Wolves were looking at him, and came to the conclusion that he was too good for Wolves, to be honest. You know, when you've got Pep Guardiola saying he's one of the best players in the world, you know, he doesn't say that kind of thing flippantly. And yeah, the special relationship's come through again. Wolves have spent 27 million on Goncalo Guedes and 38 million on Matias Nunes in 1 week. Both guest a few clients, both Portuguese. But, you know, it's easy to deride that, as opposition fans always will do.
I think it's clever. I think it's really clever.
It works for them. This will be 23 players of Portuguese nationality in their first team since 2016, which is remarkable. But like I say, it does work for them. They've got their own little Portuguese community in one corner of Wolverhampton. And the Mendes thing again, easy to deride it, but it's, he looks after them probably more than we've seen any of his other clubs across Europe, helped by the fact that his agency and Wolves' owners are linked financially. So it's been a massive week. Morgan Gibbs-White potentially off to Nottingham Forest, we see today, for a similar fee to Nunes, which sort of blows my mind a little bit.
I mean, that's that is incredible. That is incredible business from Wolves, in my
opinion. But it feels like Wolves' team is sort of coming together now. I watched them against Fulham last weekend, and they really struggled in the final third. They had an XG of 0.86, created a couple of decent chances, obviously missing a striker, but also missing this creative type from centre and midfield, and that link between midfield and attack, which they've never really had in the Premier League. You know, Neves sits a bit deeper. He's not got the pace or the athleticism to play further forward. Moutinho is the one who recycles possession, and Dendonka from midfield is the one who sort of breaks the lines, but he hasn't got the goal-scoring attributes or the agility to make a massive difference in those areas. Nunes can do that. He's physical. He can dribble. He's creative. He can score spectacular goals. Exceptional through balls. You know, he's sort of got the lot, really. Speak to a lot of people in the game this week, and they are surprised on the face of it that Wolves have managed to snare him. But obviously we know, as you say, that special relationship is the reason, and probably one of the best signings that he's been able to facilitate in the past few years.
Can I stick up for Morgan Gibbs-White in the face of Dan's slander?
It's not that I think he's a bad player. I just think that fee for Wolves to pull that in is incredible.
There's no denying, as Tim says. I mean, Nunes wouldn't have gone to another mid-table, top-tier club. It's clearly the relationship with Mendes that's meant they've been able to get them. So, of course, if you're looking at Wolves' business, if no money has been spent and they've swapped Nunes for Gibbs-White, it's clearly good business. But it's not as simple as that. Forest couldn't have gone out and signed a player of Nunes' stature and ability. They may have done so in Gibbs-White. I think the £45 million fee is a bit of a misnomer. You've got David Ornstein saying that it's £25 million up front and then presumably £20 million on add-ons. You'd think a big part of that will be Forest staying up. If Gibbs-White helps them stay up, then he'll ultimately be worth that, I'm sure. And similarly, if they are to get relegated, then Gibbs-White showed last season and has shown in the past couple of years that he's basically as good as it gets in the Championship. You know, if they get relegated this season and Morgan Gibbs-White is playing 8 or 10 for them in the Championship, then they've probably got the best player in the league. He's 22 years of age. He's played a lot of football for a player. I think he's matured a lot. You know, Tim will know more than me, but I think there were certainly some issues in terms of his application early on in his career. I think Steve Cooper, being his England youth team manager, is the manager who's going to get the best out of him. And he has a good relationship with him as well, which is crucial. So I think a 22-year-old attacking, creative, goal-scoring, English, homegrown midfielder for £25 million that can rise if he is a successful signing isn't bad business at all. And if he reaches his potential, then you know, he will be a player that will be linked to the biggest clubs in this country in a couple of years' time as well. And then you can guarantee the fee will be a lot more than 45. So it does strike me a little bit that some of the people who can't, and I'm not saying you, Dan, at all, but a lot of the people who seem very confused by the signing maybe hadn't seen too much of him, certainly at Sheffield United last season and previously at Swansea and others, where he's been very impressive.
I always felt, and I did write this at the time, that he just needed a full season in the Championship. Mm. He was never going to force his way into Wolves' first team. He needed to drop down and have that Championship season like Maddison did at Norwich, like Grealish to an extent did at Villa, Harvey Barnes we saw drop down, Mason Mount we saw drop down. I always felt he needed that, and last season he absolutely flew in the Championship. He hasn't quite taken that on in the first two games in the Premier League for Wolves, but Wolves have got a bit of a stunted attack. Positionally, I'll be interested to see where he fits in at Forest. He traditionally likes being a 10, but at Sheffield United he drifted in from the right to great effect, played it as false 9 on occasion as well. So he's got the lot, he has matured, and going to Sheffield United was a massive part of that. I think it'll be the making of him.
He's better than Ingard.
Probably, well, I would say he's probably not on as much money as a bachelor. I don't know anything anymore. I knew I'd get an impassioned defence of an EFL player of the year last year, George. I knew I'd get that from you. Right, then let's do predictions for this one then. I still can't see past the Spurs winning it, but I am very impressed with Wolves, and I will say your piece on Wolves this morning that I read, Tim, was very, very good, explaining everything. I enjoyed, not the right word, because I didn't enjoy it, but it was very interesting. Prediction from you, Tim?
I think Wolves, with a bit of momentum and a new signing, he'll probably play because Nunes played for Sporting last week. I think they can claim a point. They've won their last three trips three of the last four to Tottenham away. They've got a good record there, and I can see them nicking a point.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it'll be low scoring. I think it might be a 1-0 home win or a low scoring draw. I think the way that Wolves play will look to frustrate Spurs. We know how good Spurs are exploiting any space left in behind, but I don't think Wolves will give them that. So it could be I don't think it'll be a great spectacle for the neutral, let's say that, at 12:30 on Saturday.
Okay, you won't change my mind. Going for a Spurs win. I still fancy Spurs. But it will be a good, interesting barometer of where Spurs are actually this game, in line with what you two have said there. So yeah, I'll be enjoying it, even if it's not a great game for the neutral. Let's look now at Bournemouth v Arsenal, which is Saturday tea time kickoff. Now, George, you weren't convinced about Arsenal in the Palace win. Was there anything in the win to change
it's
your
important
mind?
Important sometimes to admit when things change, you're allowed to change your mind. And I'm not there yet. They were.
No, you're not there.
Well,
yet.
I mean, they were. It was classic Arsenal, wasn't it? They were scintillatingly good for 88 minutes, weren't they? I mean, some of their attacking play is just incredible to watch. Whether it's Jesus and the touch and the finish for the first goal, just was. We hadn't really seen him do it that much for Manchester City in recent seasons. It was a moment of sheer quality. I think Martinelli has started the season in incredible form. They all just look like they're so full of confidence, and that they look like they played with each other for a long time, which is, when you compare their pre-season to Manchester United's pre-season, this is what a team should look like, who have been drilled effectively and know exactly what their job is and what their roles are between each other. But, and there's always got to be a but with Arsenal, just the goals that were conceded were just so soft. And this, I think, is just going to continue to be their undoing.
But good reaction.
Definitely.
Good
reaction, but George. I don't think it's necessarily even like a mentality thing. I
kind of think that was a one-off. I think it was a one-off, just lacklustre.
I mean, it was kind of similar in terms of against Palace, although in Palace, the whole system changed. The way that they approached the game changed when they went ahead. At least here, they kept their foot on the gas. But I just do worry. And it's understandable. Saliba is a young centre-back. I thought he probably should have given a penalty away in the game against Palace. He then scores an own goal against Leicester, and for every other second of both games apart from those two moments, he was exceptional. I mean, that is the nature of a young, talented centre-back who maybe isn't quite as streetwise as older, less talented players who could be there instead. I think this is an incredibly exciting Arsenal side, and I think Arteta's stock is probably the highest now than it has been at any other time in his Arsenal career based on those first two performances. But I do, and away against Bournemouth, I see no reason why the soft centre should be any issue here, because I think their attacking play should be too much for Bournemouth. It's when they start coming up against sides who are a bit more solid defensively, who will be able to deal with the threats, the youthful exuberance of their attacking threat a bit better than what we've seen so far, who might punish them for their defensive lapses and as I say, a bit of a soft centre, where even Leicester, who failed to threaten for pretty much the majority of the game, still managed to score twice.
Tim, Bournemouth, Scott Parker pretty much said that they wrote off last week against Manchester City. Home game against Arsenal, would they be going in with a similar mentality, or do you think they'll think that they can get something?
It's an interesting approach Scott Parker is taking publicly, because he's basically admitted that he wrote that game off. He was very defeatist before the start of the season, saying the squad's not good enough, or the signings potentially need to be a bit better. See, I'm not really sure it's the done thing, really, to sort of just publicly come out and say how bad your team is and how they're going to lose games.
He's quite niche, Scott Parker. He's always been quite niche
in a lot of ways, including in his fashion as well. I don't really see them troubling Arsenal. There's such a feel-good factor about Arsenal at the moment, and such a momentum which they've really carried on from last season, even when they didn't qualify for the Champions League. On the last day they were getting a standing ovation and a lap of honour at the Emirates, and everyone's very buoyant about their prospects. And I can see people getting very, very, very carried away with Arsenal, because if they manage to beat Bournemouth, which you'd expect them to, they've got Fulham and Villa next two, and then after that it's Man
United. Tough games.
And then after that it's Man United, and then after that it's Everton. So we could be talking about 7 from 7 here. to start the season. Everybody except for George.
You say people are getting carried away, and then you're talking about seven from seven.
I can see it happening. No, I just think they're a very, very good mix of physicality and technical brilliance.
9-1, they're top on Christmas Day.
Interesting, I'll take that. Zinchenko's come in and looked really good. Gabriel Jesus, obviously, you know, we should have bought into that pre-season form because he's carried it on into the campaign. So, yeah, I think there's a bit of a charge from North London this season. I can see both of those two clubs doing very well.
Just as you've made the move there as well. Really, really exciting for you. Two tasty games still to come as we'll look at Leeds v Chelsea and Newcastle against Manchester City.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Dan Bardell here alongside George Ellick and Tim Spears looking ahead to the weekend's fixtures, and let's turn our attention to the Sunday TV games now, starting at Elland Road as Leeds take on Chelsea at 2 p.m.
Now Sterling, James is the man over, Reece James! Yes! Chelsea have their lead back! And it's Reece James!
We already spoke about Chelsea a little bit, George, but they were impressive in that game against Spurs. There was a lot of fascinating tactical stuff that went on in that game. Even though they didn't win, I think that game showed what a clever manager Thomas Tuchel is.
What, the tactics of holding on to Conte's hand in a handshake for a little bit longer just to instigate...
the change of formation when it wasn't working and Spurs made changes and he went to a back four for a bit. I just thought it showed how clever he is.
I agree. I thought Chelsea were brilliant. There was kind of a moment going into that game, as I mentioned in the Spurs segment, thinking that Spurs were going to be able to serve it up to Chelsea. And in that first 10 minutes, it was almost like a cup game. Chelsea just controlled the game, had all the possession, were camped in Spurs' half, and Spurs were chasing shadows. They weren't able to turn that dominance into 3 points, which would be frustrating. But you know, we mentioned in our pre-season podcast that there was so much negativity surrounding Chelsea. A lot of people writing them off as not being top four, as possibly being a side who are going to struggle ahead of the campaign based on a couple of quotes in pre-season. But you look at how good the squad is and some of the performances in recent times under Tuchel. You know, they were Champions League winners not so long ago. I think they look like they are maybe still a striker short, although I really like the start that Havertz has made to the season. I thought he was excellent despite, you know, he's never going to be the most clinical, it seems, but I thought he was very lively in the final third against Spurs beyond the missed chances. I think we're going to see him and Sterling come good fairly soon in terms of goal scoring. But I think they've started the season pretty well. It was a much better performance than we saw at Goodison on opening day, and I think they'll enjoy themselves against a Leeds side who are going to be pretty open, even if we don't have the same incredible touchline drama that we had in that game, which I absolutely loved.
Well, we might have some more. Jesse Marsh had some touchline drama in his first game as well, didn't he? So it could be, you know, two hothead managers coming up against each other here. Team Chelsea's 3 goals so far this season have been scored by Jorginho, Reece James and Koulibaly. Nothing yet from Sterling or Havertz, who George was just raving about. They need a striker. I feel like there's a lot of teams at the moment, an unusual amount of teams in the Premier League that need a striker, and Chelsea are definitely one of them.
Leeds potentially one of them as well. I mean, George said there about Havertz not being clinical enough, and that's the thing with him and Sterling, you know. Fantastic players, but you wouldn't call either of them clinical. You know, Sterling's known to miss a sitter or two as well. Doesn't necessarily have to be a classic number nine striker that comes in, but they do need a goal scorer. And I think we've seen, you know, in their dominance, certainly of the majority of that Spurs game, you know, that they should have been turning that dominance into more goals and a victory. But I do back them in the transfer market purely on what we've seen so far from their recruitment this summer. It's you know, Sterling a fantastic addition, Koulibaly unbelievable quality, and Cucurella as well, I think, again, a great addition. And then, you know, we talked earlier about the names that Man United are linked with being an absolute shambles. Well, Chelsea being linked with Anthony Gordon and Wesley Fofana, two exceptional young players who would absolutely fit into what they're trying to do at Chelsea. So it's so incredibly competitive, isn't it? I think we're going to call it a top five now rather than top six. So certainly for the time being, a big five or a big six in terms of teams anyway, rather than clubs. But it's so hard to sort of call and separate those five teams, because Chelsea, I think I said a couple of weeks ago, you know, maybe expect them to have a bad season, but purely because they're due one. But with the business they've done and what we've seen from the opening two games, they're going to be right up there. There's no doubt about that.
Very, very good in that game against Spurs. I was really, really impressed, as I've said multiple times on this podcast already. Now, George, Bamford limped off against Southampton. His run of bad luck with injuries just isn't going anywhere. But he could be fit for this one. But Rodrigo has come to the fore suddenly. He's been playing a lot of his games not as a striker for Leeds, but suddenly he's bagging goals.
Yeah, Rodrigo bought from Valencia, where he was a striker, not a particularly prolific one, but certainly a striker, employed basically in central midfield by Marcelo Bielsa, and then gets sent up front for the first time for Leeds when Bamford hobbles off and gets a pretty important couple of goals. You know, I think for Bamford, it's been quite a long time now since he was fit and firing for Leeds, and I think it might be time to start looking at some kind of succession plan. Joe Gelhart is the obvious candidate for that, but whether or not he's ready yet to start starting up front for Leeds, I'm not sure. So this kind of, not slice of luck, but having Rodrigo come in and score those two poachers goals as he did on Saturday could be a bit of a blessing. And I think for Leeds, it would be a surprise, I think, if Bamford did start here and we didn't see Rodrigo taking on that role again.
And the good news for Leeds fans is that Phil Hay has been writing that Leeds are finding it hard to control teams who attack from wide areas. So that does sound quite ominous coming up against Chelsea's wingbacks.
Reece James, not sure, rubbing his hands.
That department at all. Talk about clinical finishers. Reece James is a pretty clinical finisher, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, Norris kind of treated like a penalty, decided to dive early and put it down the middle.
Sometimes you just got to guess. Sometimes you got to guess as a goalkeeper, haven't you? I think, it was a bizarre piece of goalkeeping, to be fair. Let's have predictions then for this one. Any surprises here, Tim?
It's hard to make a case for Leeds, isn't it, in this one?
Decent start for them, 4 points, though. I've got a mate who's a Leeds fan, and he was complaining. I was thinking, 4 points, first two games. Calm down.
No, yeah, fair point. It has been a good start, but I do think Chelsea win pretty comfortably. 2-0.
Yep. Same. Yeah, 3-1 maybe.
Yeah, I think Chelsea 2-0.
Newcastle v Manchester City is the final game that we're going to look at today, the Sunday 4:30 kickoff. Now, George, according to the bookies, there is now a 73% chance of Manchester City winning the league after a strong start to the season. Would you go along with that? 73%? Bang on.
I think I wouldn't want to sell that. I think I'd probably be higher rather than lower. They've just started the season so well. They just look like, sometimes with Pep City, you know, you can see some teething issues early in the season. We saw that last season when they lost to Spurs on opening day, especially because of the amount of business, especially going out, that they've had to deal with, and then a completely different unit of striker coming in, playing up front. But they just look, you know, unbeatable after those first couple of games, creating chances at will, controlling the ball, giving up very few chances at the other end. You know, two games is a very, very small sample size, and things are going to change very quickly, and maybe they don't have the squad depth that we've seen in the past. A little bit surprised maybe to see a couple of their young players go out on loan in the last couple of weeks. James McAtee's gone to
Sheffield
United,
me,
Liam Delap's gone to Stoke. You'd have thought, given the players that they've lost, they would need, you know, given those players were often on the bench last season in the Premier League, you'd have thought they might want that depth kept nearby. But obviously, they think for their development, they want them to go out and play games, which is understandable. But as long as this team is in the kind of mood that it's in at the moment, this is going to be, I think it's an interesting time for them to play Newcastle, because, you know, they are what Newcastle want to be in not very long. And I think they're going to show Newcastle exactly how far they've got to come before they get there.
George, could Haaland find that he scores most of his goals away from home when teams perhaps come out a little bit more? Only 8 touches, I think, in the first half against Bournemouth last week. Gabby Abanlahor, my friend Gabby Abanlahor, he got slated for having the same amount of touches in one game. I think he was livid on Twitter.
How many of Gabby's were assists though? Because you know he was there creating even though he didn't get many touches. I think it's probably quite likely. I think teams that look to play a higher line. I don't think you're going to see any teams play a higher line against City, but.
Yeah, when we say a higher line,
step out from their own penalty box.
I don't think we're talking about going too far.
No, but we even saw it. You know, West Ham set up in a pretty low block on opening day, but we still saw Haaland get in behind twice. Whereas at City, teams are going to look to frustrate and play very, very deep. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. I think games like this, especially, is going to be where he's really going to flourish. You know, Eddie Howe's style of management, the style of play that he likes to, is stepping out and looking to press and looking to get the ball and play. And that, I think, is where Haaland is going to look to play off the shoulder and pick up any scraps. And when you've got, you know, the best progressive passer, the best chance creator from deep areas in the world in Kevin De Bruyne, providing the ammo for Haaland, it's, you know, I can't see why what we saw at West Ham isn't going to be a pretty consistent theme in City's away matches this season.
How much of a test do you think Newcastle will beat him? Obviously, you know, West Ham are a great side on their day. They put up a reasonable fight against Manchester City, but this feels like the hardest game they'll have had so far in Newcastle, because under Eddie Howe, they've just been so good.
Yeah, definitely, and especially at St James's Park as well. You know, that noise is going to be incredible. I was a little bit underwhelmed with Newcastle last week against Brighton, albeit a very good Brighton team, but 4 shots, 1 on target. It's not great.
He solidified them, hasn't he? Which is not what you usually expect from Eddie Howe. I've got to say, he has got that defence sorted. Nick Pope will add to that as well.
Yeah, well, that's the flip side. I mean, 2 clean sheets so far. Nick Pope's, you know, fantastic addition. The thing about Newcastle at the moment is going forward. You know, Callum Wilson will score goals, albeit he's injury prone. You know, you'd expect that maybe to happen at some point this season. But otherwise, it's Almiron and Saint-Maximin either side with Joe Linton behind. I mean, they all played a key part in sort of the momentum and the run of victories that they acquired towards the end of last season. But I do think they need some creative and clinical additions in and around that forward line. Anthony Gordon would be perfect. I don't know if there's much substance to the rumours linking him with a move from Everton. But an important couple of weeks ahead. Everybody looking forward to seeing what they can do in the market, really. I do think they need a couple of additions.
Yeah, talking of that market, George, João Pedro links are there at the moment, the Watford forward. Watford are saying that Newcastle need to come back with an improved offer, upwards of £30 million potentially could do it. Would you rate that signing for Newcastle?
I think it would be a smart signing in terms of the potential that João Pedro's got. He hasn't shown it consistently enough. His talent is definitely not up for debate. A player whose best playing is a 10, and he's a very good ball carrier. He's certainly bulked up in the last couple of seasons. But I remember watching him on his debut, it was his first championship start on opening day against Borough a couple of seasons ago. I would have thought that his progression from then, given how good he looked on that day, despite being pretty slight and pretty raw, I'm surprised he hasn't done more so far. The issue for Newcastle is that he's got 4 years left to run on his deal. So there is absolutely no need for Watford to sell. We know that Juno Pozzo isn't somebody who takes the first bid and runs. So if they're going to want him, they're going to have to pay for him. But yeah, he's certainly a player with plenty of talent. And I think in the right environment, maybe going to a club like Newcastle where he'll be part of a bigger squad rather than necessarily being relied on to play week in, week out, could suit him. So I'd like the signing, but I'd kind of be surprised if they're willing to stump up the cash needed to get him in.
Yeah, and Adam Leventhal, our Watford writer, has been writing about João Pedro and how Rob Edwards wants him to stay at Watford amid the Newcastle interest. He's saying this is the right place for him at the moment. Predictions then for this one. Tim, you first.
I feel like we're all being a bit predictable with our predictions today. Although, well, maybe that's sort of the point, really. But I think Man City will win, but it'll be tight. It won't be a walkover.
Okay.
Yeah, I think George. Newcastle will score. So maybe like a 3-1 or something like that. But yeah, but I think City will win.
I think 2-1. I think it'll be tight. I think that St James's Park atmosphere could play a part. And I'm looking forward to watching Bruno Guimarães because he's one of my favourite players to watch in the Premier League at the moment. Thank you very much for joining me today, chaps. That's all for this week. But remember, we'll be here every Friday throughout the season. Mark Chapman's going to be back on Monday, hosting the Athletic Football Podcast 4 times a week this season and giving you the best insight into the biggest stories across the game. And finally, a reminder from me that you can sign up to the Athletic for just £1 a month and you'll get the best sports writing around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. Just head to theathletic.com/footballpod to take advantage of that offer. We'll be back next week. Enjoy all the football of the weekend.
The Athletic.